and on the other side, examples of good practice. Marit Jaakola comes from University of Tampere and tells us about using social media in teaching journalism. And Jens Tönnemann comes from Kölner Journalist Schule. Yeah. Please.
Thank you. Okay, thanks, Epp. We have now been touched upon the subject of social media from the journalistic... Oh, you shouldn't have this muted.
Is it okay now?
No.
Do you hear me? Okay. Yeah, but it was muted. So, okay, are we ready? So, good morning to everyone. We have been discussing social media from the journalistic perspective now, but I'd like to introduce the pedagogical perspective and discuss a bit about using social media in teaching journalism. And this means I'm not going to tell touch this subject from the journalistic view or talk about social media or web 2.0 tools as a tool of reporting or as a means of doing journalistic work as such, but I'm thinking of social media and web 2.0 tools as a journalistic means for creating a learning environment that could be beneficial for gaining specific knowledge and gaining specific experiences from using social media that could be, at the end, fruitful for future journalists as well. But we as journalism educators have a great possibility of using a range of different online tools for purposes of scaffolding the journalistic process, for example, or classroom work, connecting students also outside the classroom. And I'm going to have a skill-based approach to this subject so that we journalism educators normally think of our courses and processes of learning from the point of skills, which can be elaborated from basic technical or digital skills further into a framework that also covers knowledge and even wisdom of social media. My name is Marit Jaakola, and I come from the University of Tampere, which is the oldest Scandinavian institution for giving journalism education, journalism training. And I'm teaching print and online journalism with our students in a newsroom where approximately 60 students come in to work as journalists, as sub-editors, ADs, photographs, and so on. But I've also been active with some younger students. We had a couple of years ago, we had a media literacy network where the idea was that young students who were under 20 years old were teaching adults and teachers to use social media from their own perspective, because a well-known fact is that, or it's very often discussed, that there is a gap between how social media and online tools are used at school or in education, and then how people use them, especially young people use them in their free time. So we had those roles turned upside down, and the idea was to learn from the youngsters. And I've also been educating Finnish teachers from primary school to the university to use social media tools. And based on these experiences and insights, I'd like to share a couple of points that could be useful for journalism educators as well. Maybe I'll start with a personal perspective, a personal view. Why do I myself use social media? As I said, if we think of social media as a reporting tool, as a journalistic tool, and as a pedagogical tool for achieving certain goals, these two views are pretty much connected. They are closely connected. By using social media in classroom, by creating an environment, a learning environment, where social media is a very natural part of communicating, we can also teach students using social media in their everyday when they are working as professionals. So there's a very fine line, if we think it like this, from this perspective, there's a very fine line between the role of a student and the role of a professional. And I think we should be aware of the benefits of this double role and make use of it. Social media, as you may know, also enhanced collaborative learning in many ways, and it can promote collaboration skills online but also offline. They often force students to take decisions on their own and to think about their organization as a group and about communication as a process in that small group. So by using social media in teaching, we can also support learning that may turn out to be very self-determined, which as such results in the development of students' metacognitive skills, so that they can better and better regulate their own learning. They are more aware of what they already can and what lacks they may have in their knowledge or in their practical skills, and they are able to seek for more information and for help and for communities that could support their learning. For a teacher, using social media or web 2.0 tools is definitely a way of overcoming the bureaucracy of university. It may be that those social media tools, which are accessible online, they are free of charge, they are very user-friendly, they are easy to adopt and take for purposes of classroom learning. They help us finding alternatives for those information management systems universities or schools usually provide teachers with. So, and then it's also good to be aware of the possibilities that if we build up an infrastructure where all the channels are open all the time, so students can continue with learning when the classroom or the lecture is over. And the more there is openness in teaching activities and learning, the more we also benefit from other communities outside the classroom or outside our institution by sharing our not only the results of learning or the results of study, but also processes, opening up learning processes. We can benefit in many ways. For example, if you just think of the PR perspective, which is usually mentioned if you ask educators why do they use e-tools, to enhance the public presence of individuals and the university. But I think there are quite many benefits, and even if educators are aware of all these benefits, there are some practical hindrances or thresholds that have to be overcome. It's not unproblematic to adopt those tools. I'm going to show some basic tools in order to gain an overview what there is and how they could be used in a newsroom, in a pedagogical newsroom, in a pedagogical way. But if we now look at the issue from the point of view of journalistic skills, I'd like to emphasize that using social media is not that different from using any other channels journalistically or for purposes of learning. Educators such as we could maybe start from identifying the traditional journalistic core skills, which has been done in many international reports, such as this from Poynter Institute. And if you just think of the core skills mentioned here, for example, curiosity, accuracy, handling criticism, having good social skills, be a team player, knowledge of other cultures, they quite well fit into what can be gained through social media as well. So when we think about those sets of skills, we should be able to develop and support in our students. We can maybe start a bit far from this triangle of Aristotelian ideas of techne, phronesis, and episteme. I think when we think about using digital tools, we very often think about those practical skills, how they are used and how they work, and we also tend to overestimate the knowledge young people have about those how things work. Or then we tend to overemphasize the contextual knowledge. Journalism education is in many schools based on gaining knowledge about media systems and journalism in society in order to recognize the journalism's role in society. And that's a very good thing, because when our students come to newsrooms or have their first experiences with journalistic work, they also have this contextual knowledge they can benefit from. But then what still needs to be added on is the knowledge about what social media is and how it works and what kind of a culture it's attached to. It's not just about using a tool, but how communities are created and how they how they transmit values and how they can be changed and how they can be turned into a resource from the journalistic or point of view or from the point of view of learning. But then I think as an educator I would never overemphasize the role of practical knowledge, which Aristoteles calls phronesis, which is practically the lived experience or the lived knowledge, the knowledge of how to make considered decisions in a particular situation, or how to apply general rules to particular situations. And that's practically, that kind of a negotiation goes on when a student or an individual meets a new tool. We have to think how to combine contextual knowledge and practical skills together, and this way, when finding a way from theory to practice or from practice to theory, we also gain cumulatively practical knowledge, which can be then used and reused in other digital environments. From a journalism educator's perspective, I, as a print and online teacher, see that regard journalism as consisting of three different layers. We have the traditional journalism, with traditional, or at least we call it traditional journalism, which was there even before those online possibilities, which was then extended to online, which also changed a bit traditional journalism. But there is still the core to be seen. Not that much has changed if you think about the importance of journalistic autonomy or the traditional values that are usually supported and attached to the journalistic identity. And then at the outer circle, there is the area of social journalism, which is a bit wilder, at least now, than these very regulated and established structures where we know what to do. But here in the area which scholars tend to call pseudo-journalistic or quasi-journalistic area, we have to reinvent journalism somehow and also apply those traditional practices to a new environment. And I think if we think of journalism relationship to pedagogics, there is also a traditional core to be seen. The classroom communication we had before we had those online tools which could help us extend our communication beyond classroom. Then came the idea of virtual learning environments with learning management systems which covered all possible pedagogical tools and which helped us publishing our material or sharing our material online, and they had clear limits. It was the program which was online and students registered and they were there all as a group and they could maybe interact with each other. But then it started to be a bit more complicated with ideas of blended learning, ubiquitous learning, and with more versatile set of different tools. So from virtual learning environments, we have now come to environments which are maybe not the same for every and each learner. They can be mobile. They are often called personal learning environments where the individual learning can regulate his or her own environment by choosing tools that he or she wants to. She can or he can negotiate with different alternatives, as does the teacher on his or her side. So, and this is also a bit a wilder zone, this Web 2.0 learning landscape, because there are so many alternatives and the scene is constantly developing. There are new tools coming and the older ones are dying, and you have to be very up to date all the time and connected and networked in order to gain the freshest knowledge we have. So from these if I look at how the tendencies or the trends in Finnish schools, for example, there is a tendency from going from these learning management systems, LMSs, towards this kind of landscapes where the teacher or then the students themselves construct the online learning environment by choosing tools that help or promote things getting done. It's not that every teacher or every student in a specific institution have the same tools anymore. And we also have different technological possibilities in being mobile, learning with tablets, or then having PCs, and it has become a very versatile landscape as well. If you think of the basic tools that should be adopted in journalism schools, I don't know how much you use these different tools, but maybe we can point out some groups of basic social media tools, which range from some community tools, from learning platforms such as Moodle as a representative of an old-fashioned learning management system, but which still covers many, many social media features. And then Facebook, and then there is, for example, Yammer or Edmodo or Ning or LinkedIn, which can basically be based on the possibility of creating a community, which where people can communicate with each other. Then there are wikis, which can also be a basis for creating a community, as we have done in our newsroom. I'll show you a bit later. And then there are wiki-like environments where you can do collaborative learning. There is Twitter, blogs. There are other tools for getting things done, such as publishing material, sharing it, or working on it. And if you have so many tools in use, the teacher has to be able to tell also to the students what the map of these different tools is. We should always have a home where everyone is, even if we then use different tools for different purposes and not everyone is using the same. And how we have done it in our newsroom, which is, as said, based on principles of blended learning and social media learning, we have this is, what is it called, Utain. It's the newspaper and also available online for our journalism education. The basic or the home for the newspaper is Facebook groups, closed Facebook groups, which is, I think, many journalism education institutions have adopted this practice of using Facebook groups for organization. There are also pages. We have to differentiate between pages and groups. There are two different functions, but this is mainly used as a journalistic tool. Groups, there is always a one shared group for the newsroom, but then students are also encouraged to create their own groups in Teams or whatever they have a project. It's very easy to create a Facebook group by just clicking create a group, and then it usually doesn't take a lot of time until all the group is has been gathered there. And then we have a wiki as an intranet, which provides the students or the workers in our newsroom with basic material ranging from schedules, instructions, style book, who is who, address book, self-assessments, and further readings. And the idea in a wiki is, of course, that everyone can edit every page. So, and if you don't want somebody to edit one page, you can also lock it. So it's very useful, for example, for gathering information about who is writing about what today or this week. And then, because everyone can edit the page, it's always up to date. Then we also have a public wiki where students can book their shifts, work shifts by editing the page, and then we also have professional journalists every week visiting or giving feedback to the students so they can also do it. It's not the teacher who has to be in the middle of delivering information from different places to other. Then we encourage this real-time text editing using Etherpads or Google Drive or Google Docs for co-writing stories. And the one benefit in this is, of course, that also the teacher can be part of the editing process. He or she can be there, see what's happening, and comment if necessary. Feedback and self-reflection are made visible in blogs and tweets can also tell about learning insights, and then there are curation tools which are used for information gathering from different sources. So we have those basic tools at our disposal, and I think when adopting those to our use, it's not a very simple task. You cannot take it for granted that everyone is able to use every tool. You have to think about these different aspects by ensuring that everyone is able to use, everyone has those instrumental skills, operational skills. They know what to do in which forum. And they are able to apply the journalistic principles, they are able to apply principles of learning in those platforms. More responsibility is placed on the individual learner. For example, if you just think about time management or privacy management, every user has to think about that when going online. And the teacher has to be able to support that. And by building up an appropriate infrastructure, we can also provide a background that supports all adopting all those things. But as said, there are problems. We have the delusion that young students can all. We fall into technological determinism and think that if we have that platform, everyone can use it. And then we see nothing happens. There's no discussion going on. No one shares anything. Or then, which has been quite interesting to see, many students show resistance to new tools. They don't think of as journalistic, for example. So there always have to be some, which I call domestication phase, or domestication stage. You have to give space for discussions. What is Twitter? Why am I now forcing you all to tweet? Because we basically do that. Everyone has to create a Twitter account in the beginning, and they are expected to tweet and to that way to adopt it to a regular use. There have to be positive and good and active examples. Those who are actively tweeting, for example, they can show for their peers how it works, and teacher can also choose some model agent, which who then can promote the use of those tools. And then, because we always refer to the resources, which we lack knowledge, we lack time, we lack equipment, the bring your own device principle is also a beneficial way of doing things, even if the university is not able to provide you with all appropriate equipment. So I think we all have to think about this, how to organize it, and my basic principles are here. You should see the relationship between journalistic and general communication skills and try to connect them somehow. Experiential knowledge is very important. It's not just about discussing these matters theoretically. You have to go to Twitter in order to experience it and in order to know what it is all about, and not just read others' tweets. What's your way of doing it? And also, teacher is an active player, not just an observer. But she or he needs to know, decide which solutions are centralized and which decentralized. You can also leave some tasks or modes of organization to the students. So I guess there is a lot of discussion, or hope that you have your own experiences on the subject and we can share them, but now it's time to go to one case, how social media has been used in one case of learning. So, thank you.
take the mic. Okay, is it working? Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Marit, for this great first step into social media usage within the classroom. Well, I'm from the Cologne School of Journalism. In Germany, we are focusing on business and political journalism, and we are not as old as the wonderful university we are currently in here, but we are quite old. We were founded in 1968, so roughly 50 years, and I tried to just put the most important points on one slide. You can go through them, I can explain them later on. The most important thing actually is that we are quite non-academic. We are not a university, we don't give a bachelor degree in the end or something like that. We give a certificate after 4 years and you get the bachelor from the university. So you have 2 degrees at the end, but ours is not academic. Which means that I cannot really tell you lots about research or things we find out at our school. We just do practical training. So one thing we do, and that's why I'm glad I have the chance to present here, is we try to get our students familiar with the social web. It actually starts there where Marit ended. How do we get the people engaged? How do we get them become, not only consumers, but producers, or as you said it, prosumers in the social web. And therefore we started, why is this actually relevant to us? I would like to introduce you Lenz, this guy here in the upper left corner. He's one of our alumni. He left our school starting as a freelance journalist, as quite a lot of our alumni do. And he went to Turkey last year to report from the Gezi protests. And he reported for Zeit Online, which is a big news site, but he also reported on Twitter. And he managed to gather lots of followers while reporting from there. And here you see a picture of one of our politicians who actually was in Gezi or in Istanbul during the protests. And he managed to interview her when there was a tear gas attack. So he published this picture. He got 350 retweets, many favorites, and he got lots of new followers. And I think this example quite well shows how important it is for journalists to be active in the social web, to find content, to get pictures, to get statements, comments, etc., for example, from the Gezi protests, to get in touch, for example, with eyewitnesses if you're not there yourself, and also to share your work, publish your articles on the web, and build some kind of a personal brand, like he did when he was reporting from Turkey. He became kind of an expert for the Turkey protests. And this also leads to the fact that he got the job at Zeit Online later on. He was hired after he reported from there. Now he has a fixed contract there, which is kind of difficult today. So he managed to do that because he brought a lot of followers to the table. He brought his own audience when he joined Zeit Online. This guy is another alumni from our school. He was working as an editor for the Handelsblatt, a daily business paper in Germany. And he started his own blog. He started to use Twitter very extensively, writing on economy. And he later on got hired by Reuters Breaking News because he did that. And this also, I think, illustrates how important it is to be visible in the social web. Do good journalism on one hand, but also share it with your followers or get input by your followers. And this is actually a slide or a illustration made by the Pew Research Center, where you can also see that big names in journalism who manage to build up their own audience are hired by new or found their own new digital media companies. And if you see names like Glenn Greenwald, you know that this name is much more popular already than the media he's working for, First Look Media. He's the brand and not the company anymore. So this is a development we try to cope with. So how do we do that? How do we turn young students who use Facebook or use Twitter or use the social web but don't really see why they should produce something there, or who are reluctant and are resistant maybe to produce stuff there, how do we turn them into producers or prosumers? Well, we started this internet site called 140z.de, because this is kind of the rhythm of the social web. 140 letters fit in one tweet. And we put up a small title up there, which says journalistic experiments in the social web. So why did we do that? Because we want to show our students, you can try yourself out here, and we want to show the readers this is kind of an experimenting field. You don't have to... what you can see here are experiments, and they may fail, but they also may go very well. So this is how we set up the page. And what is very important to us is that we still apply the four eyes principle. So before anything is published, even though it's kind of experimental, there must always be someone else who reads it before. And this is something which differentiates us from maybe other blog platforms where you just publish your article once you wrote it and then the readers check it for mistakes maybe. We try to personalize it. So we have always faces on each article. We try to get the people who are using social media in the center of the platform. And we try to create some tweetability. So each title is actually at most 140 letters long and is constructed like a tweet. So if you like the article and you just say Twitter it, the whole headline will be tweeted, and the whole headline needs to be in form of a tweet. So, we try to lower the barrier, use their creativity, make them try themselves out on this platform. And as you can see, for example, here, they try new tools and they try to be experimental. Here it was a report about a person who is using Twitter very extensively. She's very prominent in Germany. She's got maybe 50,000 followers, but she's using a pseudonym. And this is kind of interesting because the author of this article tried to get in touch with her, our student, and she didn't reply. So he wrote the article without her feedback, and he tried just to collect all the information on the web about her. And then after that was published, people showed up sending us emails telling us who she really is. So you can see that social media helps you to get new information and stay in touch with your readers, but also with your sources. This was actually part of the same series. One student portrayed this woman who is also using Twitter quite extensively. She tells her audience everything, where she is, what she does, and he created a map out of her travels. And then she was very surprised when the article turned up. And said, well, it would have been nice if you had asked me before putting this map on the web, but actually all the information used for the article were public already. So the student just put it together, and we had a very interesting debate later on below the article. Can you do that? Do you have to ask before? Or is someone with 5,000 followers on Twitter and he tweets personal stuff, isn't that public already? So we kind of create some kind of sensitivity among our students for these topics. This was another project. We asked our students to portray very popular traveling and trading routes all over the world. And because you can't go to Namibia just for a day, we asked them to find the protagonists of the text by using social media and by using Twitter, by using Facebook. And they turn up with very interesting reports on, for example, the St. Jacob's Trail. This is another recent example where we tried to turn them into creators. The students tried to cover Twitter debates between politicians and pop stars and normal users, and they used Storyfy to put together the pieces. And this was really interesting because if it works well, these people start to retweet your story and start to drive traffic to your site. So this is kind of important from our point of view as well, to get students engaged, to show them how they get feedback, how many people actually read their articles. And you can see here, for example, one article was shared quite often, or this is a very recent article from last week where some of our students tried out a Google Glass and they walked through the city center of Cologne and just recorded how people reacted on being filmed by Google Glass. And you can see that this brought us quite a lot of visitors. And finally, this helps to make them use the tools to understand that they are not only consumers but also producers, and that when they enter the third term, they already have used tools like Twitter or Storyfy. So when they go into internships, they are ready to use them in their for the media they're interning with. And one asset maybe also is that it gives us some publicity, which is also not to underestimate, because our school gets more visible by doing that. So still, we have the challenge of getting students engaged, of lowering the barrier, of showing them how to use Twitter. But from our point of view, this might be one way of doing it. And as we are not academic, we don't really evaluate the whole thing. But I think it adds well to what Merit said. Maybe we can just later on discuss what you think about it and what you maybe have in doubt when you hear that, or if ideas of this can be even copied or bettered. And what is also interesting, this is also part of the results, that students who do that later on start their own blogs. For example, this person here, he started a blog called Leuchtstaben on Inspiration, and when he was done with our school and he graduated, he was hired by the new German edition of the Huffington Post as the blog editor. So it helped him also to get a job. This is another example of one of our students who started a blog on data journalism. And then we have a student who, after graduating, started a platform on the aero branch, on flights and airplanes and stuff like that. And this is read by a community as well. So three examples of people who started to use social media afterwards and are quite keen on doing that. One more project I would like to introduce you to is Hostwriter. This is maybe also important, or a chance of using social media as a journalist or journalism student. It's a platform not launched by us, but we are kind of a partner with our school. It's a new platform that was launched last week, and it's aiming at connecting journalists all over the world, journalism students as well, so they can share their ideas and find colleagues, maybe find a host somewhere else in the world, or find someone who helps them get information in a place they are not as well connected as another journalist. And if you want to, if you're a journalist yourself, or if you would like to inform your journalism students about it, I brought a code so you can so they can join this project for free. It's absolutely free. It's non-profit, and I think it's a great way of connecting journalists inside the social web. Okay, so this is just some insights into our project, and I'm happy to answer any questions or discuss what we are doing. Thank you very much.
Yes, and I will give floor to our two next speakers, and then we have some time after that for discussion and questions all together. And Heikki Kuutti and Turo Uskali from Jyväskylä University have experimented with teaching data journalism.
Okay, I think you still need the mic.
Yeah, thanks. All right. Hello again. We have a common presentation with Turo, and I will start this as some background for data journalism. And I have a background as an investigative reporting. I made a dissertation about that topic, so I'm not very much interested in data itself. But data journalism has roots as investigative reporting, and now it seems that there are a lot of people, nerds and computer assistants, everybody who is actually invited or in some certain sense occupied the field of journalism. So data journalism is not so much anymore about journalism. It's something else. And I must emphasize in my presentation about the role of journalism in this respect. There's actually two points I want to emphasize. Data is only a source material for data journalism. It's only source material, and computers are only tools to analyze data. It's nothing else. And the point in journalism is, what do people do with data? That's the point. All right. And this is a short difference description about what's the difference between old-fashioned paper story and data story. And you can see that, in my opinion, data is some kind of revolutionary method. So it will reveal something more that nobody else had before done, because with computers and digital format. So in paper document, you're making a story, you get separate info, and you make a story based on separate pieces of info. For instance, some quotes and some facts and so forth, but it's only actually consists of pieces of separate info. But on the contrasting, when you're talking about database, which consists of data, there's an enormous amount of data, and you can make a combination data story you'll never know before you've done analysis. So as a background, in a database, there can be some new idea or revelation inside the data that nobody else has never before seen. For instance, official databases, authorities are not very much interested about what kind of data the database consists. And this is some preliminary working process of data journalism for our. You can see that data is only part of the journalist process. It's here in the broad arrow made, and narrow arrow is non-data story material. And you can see that every story is based on topic and source selection. And when you are making a selection about document, which is data format, you can use official database, open data, and editorial database, or own editorial office. And with on the basis of information request, you get some official data, and then you start making a data process by inspecting, cleaning, analyzing, and inspection data analyzing. And then you are just making preparation, as in other way. So it's only a part of data journalist process. And what do we can do with data then? We have two alternatives. For instance, we have a data, and we can think about what should we do with the data, what kind of information we can find it. This is very common in open data movement. Somebody giving you data for free and say, what you can do about it. But more journalistic beginning is that you have a journalistic questions, and you're looking for where can I find data to solve these questions, get answers to these questions. And it's amazing that there are a lot of data in databases, but nobody has ever come into mind that there could be access for this data. And this is very important that many cases you think first what can you do with the data, and then what you actually cannot do, because you can ask questions from data, many kind of questions, but you have to be aware also what kind of questions you cannot ask, because computers can do anything almost with your queries, but it's nonsense, you know. You have to think about what's the question I'm going to ask with this database. And then we are, of course, this cleaning, analyzing. All the data is dirty because it's made by humans. Entries to registers are made by humans. So you are very much aware what kind of data you're using and whether it's clean or not. And it's not enough that you are only making analysis. You have to have comments. So always you have to ask some kind of comments for your results. Whether I'm right on the basis of my analysis to this kind of publish this kind of results. Because you are very easily to be misled in this work. Data is quite dangerous material, because, and computers, you know, they can do anything. And if you're not aware of what you're doing, you are very soon ex-journalist. Okay, I'll let Turo continue.
I think this, you can keep that.
All right.
One. So what we have done, we were not the first Finnish journalist school to start to teach data journalism. We followed the experience of Tampere, and also all the other schools in Finland have already done these kind of courses. But we started last year, 2013, and just, you know, with a 6 weeks pilot course. We called it pilot course because we were not sure whether it will be a success or not, and also telling the students that we are just starting to figure out what actually this is. We started with 16 hours of lectures. We used the ACC's Data Journalism Handbook, and then we sort of forced all the students to do data journalism by themselves as a team projects. And then we had this final seminar where all the works were talked to the audience. And we had, you know, two main instructors. We had three visiting professionals also. So what they did was this kind of basic pieces you usually start when you do your first stories on data journalism. It's like you use Google Maps, you find data, and if you are good enough, you are able to publish. For example, this was published here in local website by Wiley. So this is about the accidents you can see in different years in your vascular area. So watch out there when you're walking after a couple of drinks. There is a slight opportunity to get hit by someone. Also, the students wanted to focus on parking tickets. And oh, there is a problem, but there are also several areas in your vascular area that you will get the ticket quite easily. And then even one story about using the Fjällräven backpacks by the students in the campus. So this was based on survey a couple of guys did by using email, and they were able to find out that in history, in humanities, the students use most of the backpacks. So this is the fun side of doing data stories as well. So the feedback from the pilot course, almost all the teams had project-specific problems concerning the finding of suitable data sets. So, and actually many good story ideas were invalidated by a lack of open data from those topics. And in hindsight, the pilot course was possibly too intensive, and more than 2 weeks should be allowed for developing a good data science project. So we were testing whether this could be one of our courses in the future as well. So then aiming at the next level, the strategy for this season was that we added 4 more weeks. We wanted to focus on Jyväskylä's open data sets. We had a reservation for 5 data journalism gurus visiting our course, because this is typically something, there's not only one single person who can handle all these difficult areas. So we needed a lot of assistance from other schools as well. And then we wanted to connect this course to research project called Data Journalism Work Methods. And then we found it, like with the first course, we found it a Facebook help desk for link sharing and discussions. And then we wanted also to integrate European Journalism Center's massive open online course about data journalism. So what happened? Well, first of all, of course, we are used to use Facebook groups. For example, I use in every course a Facebook group. I'm not going to open these links here. But then at the same time, we have in Finland this kind of supporting ecosystem. All those instructors who are sort of interested in data journalism, we have a special Facebook group where we can share our ideas, also our problems. Then we have this kind of open group for data journalism assistants, which is for all. So there's already around 250 followers. And then there's this kind of Finnish open data ecosystem, which is the largest one, over 2,000 followers, where we discuss and share our knowledge about open data in Finland and in the world in general. So, what happened? So, 11 students started this free open course, but not a single data story is ready yet. So, what happened? And
I took the course. It's a great course, but yeah, there were some initial problems. I haven't made my story yet. I wrote an essay though.
Yeah. So, the main reason was that when we wanted to focus on the open data from the city of Jyväskylä. I think the data has not arrived yet.
It hasn't, no.
Yes.
So we asked for it, we made the request, we went there, we talked about it.
Yeah.
After that, nothing.
Well, so we understood and we learned that this is something, you know, investigative reporters have luxury of time waiting for months and maybe years. But for an educational course, it's not a workable solution, actually. So, the main lesson we learned this season is that without data, there is no data story. And another minor setback was that actually the MOOC we wanted to sort of hijack to our course, it didn't start in the early 2014, but just a couple of days ago. So whenever you want to, you know, sort of integrate or test these kind of online joint ventures, there's always a danger that it will be delayed. And the course, like our course, it's already over when they started to have these kind of lections there. So, would you like to have a conclusion?
All right, thanks, Turo. And next we have some bad and good experience about our courses, and it's just success for you if you want to proceed with your own school. First of all, this we used as a journalism laboratory. It means that we didn't have actually very, very wise ideas what to do. We just wanted to see what will happen, and as you can see, not everything happens what we wish it to happen. So it's some kind of piloting, and we were testing whether we get data or not, and we have gained a lot of experience, bad experience, how not to get data. So we are going to, in the future, we are going to put in this our fingers in this situation. And one very important issue is that what are the questions to be answered by data, and also what are the questions you cannot answer by the data. You can, by computers, you can sort, you can use data sorting and searching and filtering and cross-indexing. This cross-indexing is a very, very good way to analyze data because it gives you a very big, I can say, bird's eye view of situation. You can see much more, much bigger patterns as you without non-existing data. So you can see something as a result of analysis nobody else has before seen. So it's very, very exciting also. So we have also made some combination of theory and practice, and seems to be at this more theory this time than practice. But practice is, of course, very important. And one big issue is this, this data access. We have, as mentioned, we had a bad experiences, and biggest difficulty in Finland, at least, that the computer systems of authorities, they are not planned according to the information requests. They actually, if you make a quick official request, they wondering, what are you actually looking for? Are you looking for some statistics or some piece of information? When we said, we want a whole database, give it in a, you know, stick. What kind of info you have? Give it to us. We can analyze it. They won't. We cannot do it. As it's including confidential information, everything. We have to sort it out. We have a reprogram everything, and it takes days, weeks. It costs thousands, hundreds of thousands of euros or so forth. So problem is that authorities, the information systems are, as you can say, Stone Age level. You know, they are using paper and so forth. They actually say that it's only in paper format. We don't believe it, but that's. And then we have to negotiate with this kind of negotiations. Might take weeks or months, or in the Jyväskylä case, maybe years, till we get the results. But we should find very, very convenient and fast ways to negotiate. And we have to actually train officials also, this sense. It's not only problem with journalists. And this know-how number statistics, you know, journalists are not mathematics, you know, they are afraid of statistics and numbers. And question is, data journalism is quantitative. So you have to know numbers, what's the percentages and change on percentages and so forth. It's good evidence, but unless you are not prepared to do it, you cannot do anything. And these tools, you know, they are new tools are maybe coming every day, every hour. So we are a little bit aware what are the best tools to use in teaching, and Excel is most convenient. It's actually the first and the most useful and most easiest way to educate young journalists. With Excel, you make a lot of everything, and as far as you are accustomed to it, you can go on with other tools. And this, of course, this cooperation with schools, we actually, I wouldn't like to emphasize our role, but we might be in Finland, and Finland is quite an experienced country in terms of data journalism. So, for instance, this EGT courses in internet, there is no course on data journalism. As I went to the website and didn't find anyone. I might be right. But anyway, this is a very new, revolutionary way to do journalism. And as I mentioned before, a lot of people are a little bit afraid of what kind of technology it requires. And on the other hand, all kind of nerds and technology advanced people are inviting or occupying the field. They are doing journalism, and it's up to us to do journalism with data and not to do data as a journalist. Okay, that's all, folks. And oh, one more thing.
Almost all, yes. So as we have learned, and I think we did this last summer in Mechelen, where we had this kind of group focusing on data journalism, and we realized that there should be this kind of starting phase, a basic level. We call with Heikki that it's a general data journalism. It's for daily use based on existing open data sets available.
Very easy.
Yes. And just, you know, teaching the basic data tools. And I think this is something we can all actually do pretty easily. But then when we want to go ahead into the next level, we call that advanced one, it's more like investigative reporting. So it's like ProPublica style of doing data journalism. What is in the shadows? The journalists really want to find out those data sets which are not open yet.
And starting point for this is other journalistic questions. They want to answer those questions, and they do anything to get the material to answer. And that's why they make information requests and are very determined to get them. Negotiate maybe weeks, months, and so forth. And that's the point of journalism in terms of democracy. You know, you are looking for the big issues, big patterns. Somebody's trying to hide from you inside a database. But anyway, that's a very big program.
And that is the third one, which is like real time. It's also called, especially by Columbia Journalism School in New York, they call it censored journalism. And they will publish a first research paper on this in 1 week in New York. They are having a special seminar there. So I just advise you to follow that one. It's based on automated news creation based on algorithms. And for example, the Los Angeles Times, they have these kind of systems working, especially monitoring earthquakes and crimes in real time. And so you can also follow our research, of course, in the real time. We have a blog, we have a Facebook group, we have a Twitter account there, and also you can use Flipboard, which is, I think, the most convenient way of learning something new. And just advertising that this research is funded by Helsingin Sanomat Foundation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we have comments from Alexandra Stark from the Swiss School of Journalism.
Hello. I'm lecturing myself data journalism at the University of Zurich. And I came here and I thought I will find answers to all my questions. But I think we have the same questions and are looking to find the same answers. I'm glad that you have students that come to your courses, because in Switzerland, since 2011 at my school, I'm teaching at the School for Journalism and also at the university. At the school, we have offered so far 14 courses for data journalism. Not a single one has taken place. So the journalists, they talk a lot about data journalism, but they don't do it. So what did we do? We tried to figure out, why is that? It's because you say data is dangerous. And I think a lot of journalists know that, and they are kind of afraid. And when they start to work with data, they quickly find out it is very difficult. So we team up with the political science department of the University of Zurich. They have the data specialists. What do I do there? I have the journalism part. There's a data person with the students, and I have the journalistic part. And what I do is I keep on asking them the question, what is your story? Why is that interesting? Why should I care about it? So this is our approach, and I really hope that we can also motivate our students, and I would like to hear from you maybe later how you do that, so that they come. I have a third point I want to mention that I find quite difficult. The data is difficult to get. I think that's in all our countries. Working with the data is difficult, but something I was missing and what we see is always a problem when you publish the data. You have this wonderful data set, and then you have the question, well, how will it look like, and how can we present it so that this complexity is not wrong, but is still easy to understand. And that's where we start now to introduce designers from the beginning of the process. Because we always have the question, how do we present it? And then we need the data to be able to present it that way, or do we have the data and decide afterwards how we want to present it? Have you been thinking about this too?
Oh yeah, visualization is very, very important, because you know people are changing sites in internet. They are not very fond of anything long sentences. But the problem is that if you make it too simple, you know, results are too simple, and it might be misleading also. So the problem is that if you are making a big analysis, a big large data set, you have to be aware that you are actually going to the right point inside. Okay.
Yes, there is a new problem emerging, which is that there are tendencies that over 50% of all the users consuming data journalism comes from mobile phones. So when you're looking at that small screen, and data journalism particularly needs enough, you know, big screens in order to use all the interactivity which is usually built in that. So that's really something which is coming right now in, and I think all the newsrooms are now right here in Finland and elsewhere. They are tackling this question: how to probably do good stories in that environment.
So I think the big challenge, at least for us, is how do you put all these different experts together so that they have one language and one goal? And I think the goal has to be a journalistic one. And what we see from our projects we do is that we have to, as journalists, we are more or less the project manager, and we have to be able to teach and to tell these people how to work in a journalistic manner. So we try to turn it around. We go to the experts and teach them.
I think in general it's very it usually starts that you build a data desk, and then you hire, you know, web developers, and then you have some, you know, with journalistic skills and graphic designer, and you build those teams. But in the longer run, I think it's typical when you look at the UK and the USA that when they have enough well-educated data journalists, it spreads all over the newsroom, and then it's like more ad hoc kind of teamwork, that every journalistic project builds its own kind of teamwork.
And I must emphasize, I mentioned before, every student, every journalist can do Excel. It's very simple, and I really advise that everybody should use it. Those sorting, cross-indexing, filtering, searching, very simple. And as far, many documents are Excel-based, so do not use experts too early in your classes, because you have to, as a journalist, you have to know what the data consists and what can you do it. And Excel is very, very handsome, or handy in that way.
Yes, thank you very much, Alexandra. And we had really good discussion already. So I guess you will have more questions and more comments. And I'm really happy that we presented also our best practice of failure, so we can learn from our mistakes.
If there are comments, you need to use the microphone because we're streaming, so no microphone, no sound. That's why.
Thank you. Okay. Yes, good afternoon, everyone. I wonder what discussions... Louder? I wonder what discussions you instructors or professors have had with students about possible repercussions of information that is published.
Can you repeat your question? We can't hear anything.
Okay, yes, hello. I wonder what discussions you have had with students about possible repercussions after publishing stories.
All right, there's some.
Well, they are not. In the first course, I think the most of the works were not published at all. They just did those. But the best ones, of course, the journalists, the students want to, try out whether there are some news organizations wanted to buy this kind of stuff. So, and there indeed were a couple of those. But in these cases, there were not, big problems publishing the data. It was not that sensitive, at least. It was open data. So, but I think there can be cases where these kind of ethical questions really are important to discuss before publishing the data. I mean, there is very often sensitive private information involved with different kind of data sets. And so I think it's pretty obvious that the journalist should sort of be very careful publishing private information. I think there are several cases in the United States where, for example, the addresses of gun owners in some cities were published openly, and that has caused some ethical problems, of course, and discussions.
Yeah, and some addition that you got some results as analysis. Do not ever publish them without asking comments. For instance, if you say that Mr. X has the highest taxation in Finland, and because our computer analysis, it might include wrong information. You have to ask, do you agree you have a high taxation? Something like that. And everything, because when you're making a mistake in data analysis, it's like you're making mistake of everything. It's so easy to make mistakes, because computers do anything you ask, but you have to know what you ask. And also, dirty data is very important, big problem. Whereas cleaning data might take much more time than analysis of writing a story. And that's problem. I think it's very bad for authorities, because they are actually maintaining the database, and they are not very much aware about that the data is dirty. They don't pay attention. It's not made for analysis. It's made for register entries, For instance, company names might have different ways, and computers do not recognize differences, for instance, letters. So that's a big problem.
I think the point I was trying to make is more to the idea that information can be dangerous for the reporter. For example, Glenn Greenwald or other journalists who publish information that is sensitive, and as a consequence, the journalist sometimes feels his life or his well-being could be in danger. What discussions do you have with students about those topics?
It's a question. Actually, everything you publish have a public interest. Depends whether information coming from you. So the responsibility is on publishing, you know, not database, not authorities, just the media or journalists. So it's same regulations as in any journalist. And when publishing data information, I can't see any difference.
Thank you. But I think there is one point I want to add, because we had this discussion. When you aggregate data, you get to a certain point where you make very general remarks. And we had one data story in Switzerland that was very heavily discussed. It was about how many foreigners live where. You know, in Switzerland, this is a hot topic. And the data was so highly aggregated that you could basically say what you wanted with this data. And it was initially thought to be just an overview and was then used for political reasons, not by the journalist, but by other people. And that was a very interesting case, because we, when we did it, we didn't think about it. And that's probably something you meant. And I think we will have to be much more aware of what can be done with this information.
Hello all. Well, thank you for your presentation. I was just getting upset when Alexandra said that you have also had these data journalism courses, but no shows. students, and I can't understand it. I'm from Haaga-Helia, University of Applied Sciences, and we have also have several of these courses, and they have been always full and successful also. Until this, we'll see. But I was just wondering, is there any reason that we cannot think that these courses must be compulsory? That why just make those that they can choose? Do they want to study it? Because I think they can't choose it anymore.
Yeah, this kind of situation requires change of attitude, you know. If you want to be a journalist in the future, you have to have this kind of skill. So this mandatory requirements is very much okay. But actually, maybe a situation, students at the moment do not recognize this requirement. They think that I can survive without data. I can make a paper stories and talking with people of everything. I don't need data. But in a very near future, I will predict that you will lose your work, you will lose your life if you don't take part in the data journalism courses. Okay. So I must very much advise it would be a mandatory course. Not here, our university, but everywhere else.
Okay. Hello everybody, Laura from Italy. I have a question for all speakers. Did your students show resistance to new tools? My question is related to our experience, because our students never show resistance to tools related to social media. A little bit at the beginning to the long form, like, for example, Narrativly or something like Storyfy. Sometimes they show resistance to e-learning data journalism. We joined the Canvas Network 2 years ago, and last year we did something like you did. But the first step, working on Excel, sometimes is really hard. Then, when they understand that this is very important for, how can I say, for investigative journalism, they understand that they can check the transparency of institution, which in Italy is a problem, as you know. But they discover that is very, very important as kind of journalism. And one of our students, actually, is one of the youngest journalists who use data to make investigations. I'm curious about it, if you find some resistance in them.
Thank you.
So I was given the microphone, so I'll start. I think that's a very relevant point, the resistance, because if we think about technology adoption, one of the things that have to be overcome is the thing that we don't, or it's our choice. It's up to us whether to use a certain tool or not, and there is always something which may feel a bit uncomfortable. Or there may be some technical or other cultural hindrances. According to my experience, many journalism students show resistance to Twitter. Maybe not Facebook anymore, but there used to be. A number of in a classroom, there used to be a number of students who for some ideological reason didn't want to use Facebook either, and that's one problem we have to think as educators, whether to force them to use Facebook, which is a commercial platform, or whether to force them to tweet with their own names. And I think that's also a very interesting observation, that they do have such resistance because they normally do not complain about writing online columns under their own name or writing any online stories. But then when it comes to using social media, they may have some resistance. And that's maybe something to have do with the personal relationship it has, because we are there as persons, we are creating our profiles and to gain audiences and for our or followers or likes to ourselves. So that's a very intimate relationship we have with those different tools. But I still have to add that students are not the only one who show resistance. It's also the teachers. There are also many teachers who do not want to have anything to do with those new tools unless forced to use them. And that's not the case at this point of social media development.
I think I would agree to what Marit said. It's the same with our students. So I think there are two difficulties which make them a bit resistant or skeptical. One is technological. They need to find out how the things work, and they need to register Twitter or register different tools and know how to use them. And the other one is kind of psychological. They, in difference to pastimes, they are more visible as a person. They maybe have to show up on the net. They will publish maybe private things about themselves, and they are not sure will be able to take them out later on, or will they stay on the net forever. So we try to make it easier for them by giving them kind of technological introduction, but also by telling them, okay, you can experiment, you can also use a pseudonym in the beginning, not use your real name on Twitter if you want to try at the beginning. And we started with a compulsory course, but we offer them the chance to continue working for our platform later on, on a freelance basis, so to say, or on a not obligatory but voluntarily. So this also shows us that some people who are skeptical in the beginning later turn a bit and continue writing for our platform, but others don't. Others just stop, and maybe some even stop tweeting or stop using Twitter, and this is something we still need to work on or find out if we can change it or if it's impossible to change.
And it's all typical that those who are often the most skeptical turn out to be the most eager users at the end.
Yes, we have exactly the same experience. So 3 years ago, there were some problems with Facebook and Twitter, but not anymore.
Yeah, and coming back to Excel, for instance, it's like you can compare Excel use as a learning bicycle driving. You know, it takes, it's very slow in the beginning. It might take days or weeks to learn, but as far as get accustomed to this, it's very fast and convenient. So don't get frustrated in the beginning. And as far as you can collect your own data in your own database, you can also make Excel documents. It's getting more exciting, you know. You have the data no one else has. And your own story.
I have a very technical question. I come from Republic of Georgia, Caucasus School of Journalism and Media Management, and we experiment also these kinds of, data journalism, different tools. And we found a Google spreadsheets more convenient rather than Excel, because sometimes Excel just, you know, does not perform something. While you just copy-paste these things in the Google spreadsheet, and, you know, it gives you more opportunities. Do you have the same experience?
Yeah, it works nicely as well, yes. There are, like, 10, 15 basic tools. It depends on what you are fancy with and capable of doing and starting with. So, yeah, it's good as well, yes.
Yeah. And also, access information, usually the officials have Excel documents in their computers, and they can send it by email, so it's Microsoft Excel documents.
I wanted to add something, how to encourage the students to use these new tools. We, 3 years ago, we train people from really small papers, and mostly papers. So they say, we don't need all this online stuff, and because our readers don't want that. And we first said, we don't accept students anymore that categorically don't want to use this medium, because we say that our readers, they start using it or are already using it, and as a journalist we have to know why they rather spend time on Facebook or Twitter than on our sites or with reading our paper. That was the first thing we did, and there was a bit a problem, but not really. And then we started to introduce that they have to develop like a digital presence. Throughout these 2 years, they are studying with us. They work full time, and they come to school 90 days in these 2 years. So they have to develop their digital presence. And they can choose what they do, but they then have to explain us, why have I a blog? Why don't I have a website? Why do I use Twitter but not Facebook? And they just have to explain it to us. And if they can do it, it's fine. And if they just say, because I don't want to, they fail. So we are quite strict with that.
Thank you. Nico Kussendrager, Utrecht School of Journalism, the Netherlands. I do have a question to Marit. You are talking about pseudo-journalism. What do you mean by that? Is it public journalism? And if so, could you not better call it public debate? Is it journalism?
Sorry, I didn't hear the first part of your...
You were talking about pseudo-journalism.
Ah, yeah.
What do you mean by that?
I mentioned a pseudo-journalistic area. Mm. It was not pseudo-journalism as such. I meant that the discussions going on in social media are partly journalistic, from if we think about journalists being in social media, but they are also... it's communication by citizens and organizations and others. So defining those areas where journalists go to social media as pseudo-journalistic means that the rules that are applied are not just purely journalistic, because you cannot control the area of social media as you can maybe try to control your online magazine or online site. So that's a mixture of journalistic principles and journalistic action, as well as citizen action or other kind of mass communication or communication. And that was it's actually a concept used by Alfred Hermida, pseudo-journalism, journalistic zone or area.
Thank you.